Let's start with TV. Trespasses is a four-part drama on Channel 4. It's adapted from Louise Kennedy's acclaimed novel set in Northern Ireland in the 1970s. It follows Cushla, played by Lola Pettigrew, a Catholic schoolteacher who works in her family's pub at night. When she starts a secret relationship with a Protestant solicitor, Michael, played by Tom Cullen, their romance ignites sectarian tensions and IRA violence. Apple TV bring us Pluribus, a sci-fi drama created by Vince Gilligan, who wrote Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. It stars Rhea Seehorn as Carol, a famous romantic author who one night finds herself immune to a huge change around the world. And there is little else I am allowed to reveal to you about it, and we will explain all of that later. Lastly tonight, Disney brings us Ryan Murphy's much-hyped legal drama All's Fair, starring Kim Kardashian, you heard me right, and Naomi Watts as ruthless divorce lawyers in an all-female practice. The series follows them as they take on celebrity splits and confront their own messy romances and rivalries. It also stars Glenn Close and Sarah Paulson as rival lawyers. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have watched all three and join me now. First up, let's start with Trespasses on Channel 4. Jen, the book was a huge success for Louise Kennedy, and rightly so. Channel 4 tried to tell us the story in four episodes, so set this one up for us, please.
They're cramming it in, because anybody that has read the book, and there's so many people out there, and have loved it deeply, I think it's kind of akin to Normal People, where you have that trepidation about what are they going to do to these characters, how are they going to capture the language, how are they going to capture the depth and the scope of it all in four episodes. And they do that admirably, I have to say. And it is down to screenwriter Alfie Keoghan, I think she worked for Bad Sisters, Sharon Horgan's, and the director Don Shadforth. And they've handled the material really sensitively, I think. And it's very effective. And with Louise Kennedy as an executive producer on board as well, you get her seal of approval as well. So I think for those who haven't read the book, it is the story of Cushla, played by Lola Pettigrew, who we've seen in Say Nothing. And she's a young Catholic schoolgirl, a school teacher in 1975 in Northern Ireland. And her life is dominated by the Troubles. And you can see within the classroom, she's trying to give the children in the classroom this sense of normality, this break from the grueling and grinding violence that they're seeing every day. But it is infecting the classroom as well. And she's very much touched by one child in particular, Davy McGeown. He's part of a mixed faith family, and he's living in a Protestant area, and their family are suffering horrifically through that. So then he's pulling at her heartstrings, but then at home she also has to worry about her glorious wreck of a mother, Gina, played by Gillian Anderson, who is mired in grief after the death of her husband and is becoming an even worse alcoholic than she ever was. So she's spending her days dissolving into the couch, watching everything from the Generation Game to the news and giving her commentary on everything around her. So she is beholden to her mother at home, but then she also has the family pub that she's working in at night time, and that's where her brother works. He kind of holds the family purse strings in a way and has a lot of control over that. And that's where she finally meets Michael Agnew, who is this Protestant lawyer, and he's married, and he is the bomb that drops into her personal life. And she begins to then start questioning everything around her and wondering how long this affair can last.
Okay, this is one of the first moments that the two of them meet. This is Michael ordering whiskey from Cushla, who's working behind the bar in the family pub, Tom Cullen and Lola Pettigrew.
Could you throw another in there for me, please? Would you like one yourself?
I'm teaching in the morning. Thank you, though.
Alan Merlin's put the Perrier's in this, in my opinion. And McDowell, he's been pigeonholed since Clockwork Orange.
I couldn't finish that book, never mind the film.
The film's beautiful. Even the violence is exquisite.
He wrote that book after his wife had been attacked by soldiers.
He turned his suffering into art.
I'd rather art without the suffering. I'm sure his wife would too.
Can you have one without the other?
God, what are you, an artist?
No. But they do say that all barristers are frustrated actors.
Chris, that relationship between Michael and Kushla is like the pivot point of the entire story here. And it's a lot more than just that of a married man having an affair with a younger woman.
It really is, yeah. And I was a little bit worried about it because I, having not read the book and knowing very little about the story, I was worried that there might be a bit too much going on in here. And that complex tales like this, I mean, think how many, you know, stories set in and around the Troubles tend to over-explain the facts or tend to over-egg the drama. But I thought that that affair and then all of the other themes and all of the other ideas that Jen just discussed, like, they actually connect very, very well. It all comes together beautifully. And there is actually a normal people vibe about their relationship, despite the fact that he is so much older than her, that he has this family, that he is very happy to, you know, introduce Kushla, that is, to his friends, but she's not allowed to say anything about their relationship, despite the fact that there is just so much wrong with it. It's actually quite beautiful and it's quite tender and it's quite thoughtful. The relationship, though, that I found most interesting was that between Gina and Glorious Wreck, is a fabulous way of putting it, and her daughter, because this is a community and this is a time where everybody, we've got Lorcan Cranish living across the road, who's a fabulous nosy neighbour. He's the type of guy who's always putting out his bins whenever someone's walking by because he needs to know what's happening. But this is a time when everyone outside the door is always looking over their shoulder, and then we have this character Kushla, who even when after she closes the door, she's still looking over her shoulder because her mum just will not let her live a life, and she's constantly asking her about where she's been, who she's been with. I mean, Kushla, it gets to the stage where she has to actually pretend that she's in a relationship with Jerry, at the beginning at least, this wonderful man that she works with, who is romantically interested in her, but when he gets the message, still wants to be friends, played very well by Oisin Thompson. But she basically, Kushla just has to, you know, create this entire lie about her personal life just to please her mother. And I thought that was the most interesting part of the series for me.
Okay, there's a moment here with the two of them. So Kushla is coming home from work and discovers that her mother has been smoking and drinking a little bit more than usual in the house. Lola Pettigrew and Gillian Anderson as her mother.
And a man. Michael. His 40s. Dark. Awfully, awfully.
Oh, Michael Agnew.
There is a blast from the past. Horse Prod lives in one of them big houses up on the hill.
You know him?
He used to come into the bar a fair bit years ago. Your daddy liked him. He was good crack. Kept his politics at home back then. Christ, I hope he doesn't bring trouble in on Eamon.
How do you mean?
He upsets his proddy lot by defending some of our lads.
He was gorgeous back then. He's thrown the knickers off you.
Yeah. I hear the wife's a sorry story.
Sorry, Hora.
Fond of the drink.
Fond of the drink, is she? God bless her.
Aye.
Right. Let's get you to bed.
Talk to me about the atmosphere, Jen, because it's set in 1970s Northern Ireland, not specifically in Belfast, but outside of Belfast. And from that opening scene in the Anchor Bar, it seems really convincing.
There is a mix of things going on here. I mean, it might sound heavy because of where it's set. So that you have the fact that Trespasses is about secrets, about everybody has something within them that they have to hold on to. Like within the pub, there's a mix of IRA men and RUC men, and they're, you know, everybody's wondering as they're sitting beside each other at the bar, who is there? Who am I talking to? Are they an informant? And then it's the secret of Kushla and Michael's relationship. But Michael introduced her to his Archie friends who want to learn Irish, and Jerry, you know, keeping hidden, what is he keeping hidden under that smile? Like, that's so convincing. There's something else going on there within him. Everyone is keeping those secrets that are like a powder keg. But at the same time, it has this breathless quality to it, this rush of, it's a coming of age story as well. And it's about her first love. And you are totally with her as Kushla when she's hitting the steering wheel after she's, you know, with pure joy after she spent her first night with Michael, and then when she's, you know, triple checking her hair in the mirror before she goes to the pub to maybe catch a glimpse of him, but then also her disappointment, her abject disappointment when he might not turn up. And she, like, Lola Pettigrew gives such a great performance here. It is beautifully measured. There's a lot of youthful exuberance within it, but there's also a sparky realism. There's the pain that she endures as well, but it has a lot of comedy in it too. You can hear that within the conversation she's having with her mother there. There's a lot of great expressions like he had a great head of hair, you know, fond of the drink, all of that. And there's the ridiculousness of the 70s that explodes into their lives with dancing to Tiger Feet by Mud, sending letters to Jimmy Savile. It's all within there. So it's not just a one note piece about the Troubles itself. It's about how to they're trying to live their lives against this as a backdrop.
It was the small little things as well. Sorry to go over. It was the small little things that really worked for me, like Barry Ward playing this man Victor, who's friends with Michael at this dinner party where Cushla is teaching them all of Michael's Protestant friends Irish. The look that he just keeps giving Cushla, because he knows that he eventually does say things that he shouldn't, but it's almost as if he just wants to take his anger about, you know, everything that's happening at the time out on Cushla. Or Lola Roddy sitting at the bar that Martin McCann's Eamon owns, and just how everyone else, or maybe Cushla, thinks that everyone's oblivious to what's going on, but he spends all of his day watching other people, and he knows. And little things like Gina in the background, you know, when Cushla's not looking, taking out a bottle from behind the couch. It's those tiny details that make up a drama. So there's an awful lot going on the surface.
In terms of accents, it's always something that we're probably ultra cautious about when you have people who aren't necessarily from Ireland or Northern Ireland playing those roles. How do we fare here?
Well, I mean, Tom Cullen, he's a Welshman, and I think he equips himself really well. I think the Michael in this is reflected through Cushla's eyes. So there's a sense of this visionary hero about him, and he's very self-assured, but he's gentle and quite disarming and charming, obviously. But he's also arrogant. You can see that arrogance coming through. And I do think that chemistry works really well between the two of them. Now, Gillian Anderson, I think everybody's slightly worried. I feel like that it's like the performance in The Crown. There's something about it that can veer almost close to parody. Now, she's very good with the accent, I will say, but at the same time, I did get this feeling that her performance is a little too oversized for the subtlety that was within the show. Not to say that it's a bad performance, but sometimes I think it's in the dialed down moments just between her and Cushla that sometimes you can get that emotion from it, and that's what's great about them as a partnership. But I think sometimes she layers it on a little bit too thick for my liking.
I'm always interested in your stars. I'm particularly interested because obviously one of you has read the book and one of you hasn't. So Jen, give me stars.
I mean, for me, I think there's a really aching, soulful quality to this. And even in the camera work, there's these fuzzy close-ups of the couple. There's the softness of the drizzly rain, the expansive hillsides, and then juxtaposed with this, the horrible daubed slogans on the walls, and you feel them closing in. And it's darkness and shade, and there's a darkness and shade within all those performances. I think it's really wryly funny, completely heartbreaking. And I think it will give readers of the book a sense of satisfaction for sure, and it's masterful storytelling. So 4 out of 5.
Okay, Chris?
Yeah, I think it's beautifully made and beautifully measured, brilliantly performed, and a great story like this requires great performers, and I think Alvy Keoghan has that. So as I say, it all connects, it all just comes together so well. 4 out of 5.
Okay, that's Trespasses. It starts on Channel 4 this weekend. A new series from Vince Gilligan, the man behind Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Before we set this one up, Chris, we may need to explain that even though the first two episodes are up already, we've been asked by Apple to not mention quite a long list of things with regards to this. So set it up in as much as you can.
Well, we can't say anything.
it's
a television show.
It's on television.
Yes, it's made by the person who made Breaking Bad. I love that, you know, Apple TV asked us not to say much at all, but I love that they did provide a short and snappy synopsis before we watched anything, and that is that the most miserable person on earth must save the world from happiness. And as far as a show synopsis goes, that is up there with the best of them. I'll be very careful. I'll just say that we have basically a character in America, in Albuquerque, who is an author, Carol is her name, who is an author of romantasy novels, is one of a few, one of, let's say, a dozen people in the entire world who is immune from a seismic shift in humanity. Something happens. It might be a virus, it might not be, I won't say anymore, but something happens that makes humanity content, that everyone loses their individuality. There's something of a world peace at play here. But Carol is the only one in America, at least, who is exempt, and she's wondering why. This is the most cynical person in the world, the person who, before the world changed, had, you know, on the surface at least, everything, a successful career, a loving relationship, a beautiful beautiful home, but she always still found ways to kind of give out about everything. So you can imagine when she's left out of this huge change around the world, she's still going to give out. I think that's about maybe as far as we can go.
You've done some amazing tap dancing.
I'm just dancing around the whole thing.
There's people from Apple outside the door.
You're not supposed to see them. Jen, you weren't really a fan of Vince Gilligan before this. So did it mean that you went in with slightly lower expectations?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I just think I'm glad that he's moving away from the worlds of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. And what better way to do it than be like, annihilation of the universe or potential or what utopia, what is this? And I think that's a great bold move, and only somebody that has had those years of experience behind him as a storyteller could do something with this dramatic a flourish. And I think it's interesting to see what he wants to get out of the sci-fi genre in a way. What it is for me is, I think when Chris is setting that up there as much as he could, it might sound a little bit like The Leftovers, but the tone of Pluribus is, for me, it sits midway between something like The Good Place, maybe, The Truman Show, there's shades of Groundhog Day. There's a comedic tone to it. There is dramatic. There's a lot of heavy subjects and going on here, lots to chew over and think about, but it's not done in such an overbearingly intense way, even though the character of Carol very much is. And I think the success of the show will probably depend on how much you want to take this particular journey with Carol as a character.
This tango is better than anything I've ever seen on Strictly, ever. Let's play. We did have a number of clips lined up, which we've now decided we can't play. We can play this one. This is Carol and her wife, Helen. They go for a drink and discuss what sort of book romantic author Carol should write next. This is Rhea Seehorn as Carol and Miriam Shore as Helen.
Maybe it's time for your serious book. Why not? You've been plugging away on it for 5 years.
4.5, barely.
Pardon me.
So put it out already.
I can't just... It needs polishing. Obviously, I mean, it does, right?
But okay, take the next few months and polish. I'll work it out. I'll buy you some more time before your next wife, Carol.
You really think Bitter Chrysalis is that good?
I think people will love it. You ever read Finnegan's Wake?
No.
I tried to in grad school. It's probably great. I don't know. All I know is it made me miserable trying to get through it. I figure you make even one person happy. Maybe that's not art. It's something.
Yeah, definitely. Chris, so for fans of Better Call Saul, Rhea Seehorn is back here, without the ponytail this time around. Her character, Carol, is based in Albuquerque as well. She carries pretty much all of the story here. What did you make of her performance?
I thought she was just tremendous. You can see why Gilligan wrote the entire series around her, or wrote the part for her, because this is a series that you're going to hear a lot of people describe it as genre bending. It really is. You know, it's a sci-fi satire in one respect. There are elements from the extraordinary pilots that are like something from, you know, a post-apocalyptic horror or even a zombie horror at times. I won't say any more. You know, it goes into black comedy territory.
Because it both is and it isn't.
Yeah, is and it isn't. There's some black comedy in there, conspiracy thrillers. If you are going to work with that many genres, then you need a performer who's going to be able to master all of those. And I think Rhea Seehorn is that performer. She is entirely believable as the cynic of the piece. You know, she can manage the comedy very well, the physical comedy, the thriller aspect. She plays the panicked sort of action hero as well in the first episode, without giving anything away. And you also, you know, you feel just devastated for her when some awful things happen to her as the series progresses. I would watch her all day. That being said, I did ask myself, the first hour is up there with the best thing I've watched all year. I loved it. And I was just, I think I held my breath for the whole thing. I did ask myself after, can Gilligan, you know, sustain that suspense the whole way through? The short answer is no. But that's okay. It does slow down because it needs to. You can't have a whole series where it's just pow, pow, pow the whole way. And so it does get to a point, we were just talking about this before, where it starts to rely maybe a bit too much on Rhea Seehorn. And again, you know, it's fine. I'm happy to watch her, but I think it will I think it will drive people mad how slow this thing gets. It's my kind of weird. And it did actually remind me at times of the Leftovers, but a bit more optimistic than the Leftovers. But I do, I can see people getting a bit frustrated with it.
Jen, like speculative fiction, it's always about saying something about the world we live in now rather than the world that the story is set in. What do you think that Vince Gilligan's trying to say here? Or is it just way too early to guess?
There is so much going on here. Yeah. You can get so much from this. It's bursting with these huge universal themes about human consciousness, human nature. What are you willing to lose for peace? It's also about global homogenization, cultural imperialism, our own obsession with happiness, the wellness industry, the commercialization of mental health. And that sounds so vast, but it is grounded in our hero's story and how she is going to untangle all this and what it means for her within her life. And I like that it's so challenging and there is these big ideas and it's so inventive. And I think viewers will enjoy that unpredictability about it and the way it's crafted. You're constantly thinking about where you would stand within this new world. Do you agree with Carol, or is she making trouble for herself? And nothing is black and white, and that's where the fun kind of comes from it. My mind changed all the time within every single episode. One time I was completely on Carol's side, the next episode I was like, actually she's wrong. You have that inner turmoil, you're going along with her. But I do think I agree with Chris, it slows down completely, and Carol can be an exhausting character, and I think that's why it's good to space these episodes out. It's not a bingey watch, and that's the way Apple are doing it. They have two episodes out now, and then you'll get the next week to week. And I think that's the right idea, because you do need time away from her, time away from that world, to ruminate about these big ideas, and then to come back with a fresh eyes again to it and re-enter that kind of place,
like
space.
We used to in the old fashioned
days.
Stars for you.
For me, I worry, because I know that there is already a season two and on the cards. And I'm thinking, like Severance, you wonder, will this grandstanding all pay off at some point? There is a lot of world building that's going on. I understand that, but I get this creeping feeling. I just wonder what the point of it all will be eventually. And I hope they'll wrap it up sooner than later, because you don't want something like this to become bloated and meaningless at the end of the day, because there's so much meaning within there. But performance-wise, incredible. So complex. She will be on that Emmy podium, I would say, next year. So for me, 3.5.
Okay, Chris?
I think the confidence on show here is just off the charts. And I like that Gilligan, after Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, came out of the pandemic and asked himself the question, what would happen if the entire world got along? It would be terrifying. And this series shows you how. Again, I'm not giving anything away, but this series really does show you how. I think Rhea Seehorn is brilliant. I'm with it. I'm worried about it a little bit, but I'm with it. So 4 stars for now.
Okay. Finally, we arrive at All's Fair. It is the highly anticipated legal drama from Ryan Murphy on Disney+. It boasts an all-star ensemble of leading ladies and one very famous global influencer in Kim Kardashian. That noise you might just be able to hear is Chris and Jen sharpening their knives. Jen, get us started.
Oh, God. Okay, where to begin? I mean, I could begin with Ryan Murphy, because I think he's such a strange presence and he's had such massive influence on television over the past 10 years, 15 years nearly. And I think we need to talk about Ryan. And I've spoken about him a lot on this show in different, you know, guises. But I do think there's something about what he does. Back in 2003, when he had something like Nip Tuck, it was almost Bret Easton Ellis-like in its gruesomeness. That's something he's interested in, this darkness under the sheen of, say, something as glamorous as plastic surgery in a way, or life in LA. And then he has this campy side to him, which you've seen in shows like Popular or Glee or even Prom Night. There's that camp edge to him. But then he also understands the essence of pop culture, and he's very good with referencing, as we've seen in, you know, American Crime Story, the brilliant O.J. Simpson one, and the lesser, it is diminishing returns. But then he comes back to obsessions with horror, with something like American Horror Story, but also the really exploitative side of things with the Monster series for Netflix. I do think there's something within that. This man understands inherently what trash is. And at one point, it was what he was trying to say, I think, was that it is something rewarding. But now I think he's almost punishing us, saying you're willing to put up with anything. Him and his coterie of writers. And I will say, on All's Fair, this is a show that's supposed to be about a female-led law firm. And I don't think that's legal that they only have female clients, but let's brush that under the carpet. But it's an all-male writers. There's only one female writer on this show, and it shows. We are living in a post-Greta Gerwig Barbie world, and I think this is undone anything that was within that. This show hates women. It is basically created, I think everybody's seen and knows, it's a basically a story about, you know, it's like a 9-to-5 story where these women set up their own law firm because they're sick of the sexist men. It's so crudely drawn within the opening, head-spinning opening episode, which I thought, there's something wrong with the way I'm playing this because of how choppy it was, like just the introductory scene. I was like, what's happening here? It's not even well made. But I do believe that when you get into it, it's not created as a TV show. It's created for memes. It's created for people to put up clips on their Instagram and go, can you believe Sarah Paulson and Glenn Close are saying these disgusting things? And who they're saying these disgusting things about is Kim Kardashian. And it may look like she's in on the joke because she's an executive producer, but I really feel he's mining her for all it's worth for snarky online comments and for people to laugh behind their hands at her.
You do not need the internet in order to hear such things, because Carrington Lane discovers that she has not been invited to join the other female lawyers in a new company and confronts the only female partner in the firm, Dinah Standish. This is Sarah Paulson and Glenn Close.
I'm your fucking protege. I'm the hardest worker, the smartest fucking A student, and I'm the one they're abandoning?
That's a gift from Golda Meir. Do you know what Golda is famous for saying? Not being beautiful was the true blessing. It forced me to develop my inner resources.
Are you calling me an ugly duckling? So what if I give myself home perms? It's economical. Fuck you.
Car, being angry is easy. Figuring out who you want to be and how to be it, that's the work to do if you want to be chosen.
I will start my own law firm. I will walk out of here.
And I'll pack you a lunch with an apple and some Pepperidge Farm goldfish. Grow up, Carr. It's time.
Chris, what about the writing?
It's unintelligible at times. I think Murphy's writing here just, it enters a whole new level of chaos. I've never been a huge fan of him, but he really has been allowed to, you know, indulge his worst storytelling habits here. It prioritizes shocks over storytelling, puerile put-downs over, you know, coherent plotting. It's vulgar, it's crude, it's quite clueless. Doesn't really make an awful lot of sense at times. It upset me because Glenn Close, she kind of wears the look of a performer who maybe was filming something next door and popped in for a visit and then somehow got, you know, convinced to stick around. We have a part that would be perfect for you. And next to Naomi Watts, who looks as if she lost a bet, the two of them, they're really sinking here. Maybe they're trying to make it work, but it's not working. The dialogue here sounds like it was cobbled together with a malfunctioning AI app. It really is poor, but I think, and I know everyone's been hard on her, but Kim Kardashian's performance here, it's car crash stuff. And I find it so ironic that for a woman who has spent her entire life in front of the cameras, that she is incapable of registering anything along, anything like human emotion. It's just expressionless, empty. You know, you wonder why, surrounded by actual proper actors, that nobody called her out in it. And then you think to yourself, oh wait, hold on, she's an executive producer, and so is Kris Jenner, her mother and her manager. So power can get you an awful lot, you know, even on that talent just counts for nothing here. It's just so icky, so badly put together, so toneless. I hated it so much. And I'm probably making it sound like, hopefully people listening to it are not thinking, well, I must watch that. That's going to be so much
but
fun.
But people will. See, this is the problem. I think that's what Ryan Murphy is counting on. He's like, that's why I'm saying it's made for memes.
Yeah.
Because it's so outlandish. Because they want to hear Sarah Paulson say misogynistic expressions that have been used against Kim Kardashian in her own real life by trolls on the internet. Now they get a great respected actress to parrot that back as well, which I think is disgusting, which I do think is a real problem here, because I think he is actually trying to make a fool of Kim Kardashian. I find this to be it's really crazy. Like the show, it's not even a show. It's an ad. It felt like flipping through Vogue at one point with all the ads for Birkin, luxury goods, Birkin, Gucci, Mercedes-Benz. There's a point where Kim comes into the office and she's wearing what could only be described as business assless chaps. They're handed champagne when they're going through briefs. It's not campy fun though. I wish it was campy fun. I wish it was Valley of the Dolls. I wish it was How to Marry a Millionaire, but it's stripped away of any kind of meaning, no characterization, no nuance. It reduces feminism to a bright pink bumper sticker on the back of a car. It's actually so upsetting to me because I think it is the perfect show for the Trump administration. It's about greed, it's about open stupidity, and it's about women being the butt of every joke.
Okay, before I ask for star ratings out of five, I would like to point out The Guardian and The Times in the UK have both scored it a zero, which, you're right, in and of itself is going to make people want to see it because they've scored zero. It's getting 5% on Rotten Tomatoes at the moment. Stars, Chris?
Yeah, it actually started out the week on 0% Rotten Tomatoes. And you know what? Like, Jaws the Revenge, one of the worst films of all time, where the shark literally roars at its prey, had 2% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's how bad this thing is. And those things shouldn't matter, Rick, but they do. And it really is that bad. As I said, it's car crash stuff. It's so mean-spirited, so lazy. I'm going to give it half a star because it ended. But I can't quite believe that this show exists. It is the worst thing, not just the worst thing we've reviewed in this slot. It's been one of the worst things I've ever watched.
Yeah, Ryan Murphy, yeah. Get better. Like, that's all I can say is what do you want from TV? And I'm asking that to viewers as well. What do you want from TV? Do you want it to just be these bite-sized clips of mockery, or do you want a real show? I think it's just there for people to get a dopamine hit of gossip or outrageousness, and that's not good enough, so zero.
That feels like an awful way to end our time together here. Have a lovely weekend, both of you. Thank you so much for coming in, Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. Trespasses begins on Channel 4 this Sunday. Pluribus is streaming on Apple TV. And All's Fair, if you choose to, is on Disney. You are listening to Friday Night's Arena. Florence and the Machine return with Everybody Scream following 2022's Dance Fever. This new record delves into grief and healing, inspired by the aftermath of a medical emergency and a period of deep reflection. With production from Aaron Dessner, we spoke to his brother Bryce last night here on the show. Next, Kat Burns, the London-born Brit School graduate whose 2022 single Go became a viral hit. She releases her second album, How to Be Human. You may know her better from her appearances on Celebrity Traitors. Burns brings together folk pop influence and soulful vocals to explore love, loss, and neurodiversity. And finally, White Lies are back with their seventh album, Night Light, emerging during the late 2000s post-punk revival. Their debut, To Lose My Life, went straight to number one and established them as part of an anthemic wave alongside bands like Editors and Interpol. I'm joined by Zara Hedeman and Kian Sullivan. We will start with Florence and the Machine. Zara, where are we here with this album? It almost feels like we might be back in the territory of Lungs here.
Yeah, a little bit actually, because funny enough, that was kind of where I got into her. A lot of people did, obviously it was her first album, but it was also where I dropped off with her. But I found this album really brought me back, like, of all of the amazing textures she has in her songs. Like, I forgot how integral, like, harp is and all of the lovely, like, kind of string motifs. And then also just how propulsive percussion is in her songs, which of course is a huge part and a huge driving part of the live shows that she gives. And as, like, this album we'll get into more, her love of performance is so big in her artistry, so much so that she has broken her foot twice in 10 years, and that is something she references quite a lot in this. Like, literally says that, you know, she's broken bones, blood, bruised, battered, like dragging herself, but at the end of the day she can't actually stay away from the fans, the stage. But in this as well, I actually found it really interesting kind of reacquainting myself with her and kind of getting to almost catch up with someone that you haven't talked to in a long time, and hearing like that the medical emergency, like how she had the massive internal bleeding from an ectopic pregnancy on her last tour and how she had to have life-saving surgery. Like, that was really shocking. And, like, of course, Music Pure, the most personal album, we don't like to say it out loud, but I actually feel it's very warranted on this. Like, she does get quite deep and quite raw and very honest with her fans. So coming back, I actually appreciated that insight.
Keen, so musically, let's talk about that. Her albums can be at their very best, very ornate. Again, harps, choirs, strings, those big percussion sections. Did this surprise you in terms of arrangement, production? What's the album like?
No, I think it's very much in the keeping of her world. And like Sarah, I've kind of been along for the ride for longer. Yeah, this, you know, I think this has all the trademark Florence hallmarks. It swells, it swoops, it has dramatic drums. She wails, she warbles over all of it. Like, it's a big sound. And she actually talks a lot about her big sound and how she takes up so much space in this record, and how she gets criticized for it, and you know, critics comment on her, friends are like kind of like slag her for being overly exuberant. So it feels like it's kind of something she's become self-conscious about. And what I think we experience on this record following the medical emergency is someone who's realized she's got nothing to lose. She's like really emboldened by her medical history. She's got a lot of things to say. There's a lot of gated rage. There's a lot of things that are built up that are spilling out in this, and it spills out in the music, and it spills out in, honestly, I think, some of the best lyricism of her career. I think what is sacrificed here, I think, is melody. I think it's maybe not as melodic or as catchy as some of her other work.
Okay, let's take a track from it. This is Florence and the Machine from the Everybody Scream album. It's a track called Witch Dance. Witch Dance, Florence and the Machine. Zara, she talks on the album in a couple of the tracks about how differently she thinks women artists are treated to men, doesn't she?
Yeah, and I think she does it in a very good way, where I think sometimes it's a difficult one to kind of talk about, because I think sometimes it can be done and it's almost a bit like, woe is me. But actually here, she does it really eloquently and actually just very straight uply. Like, she talks on One of the Greats, which is like the kind of key moment of this. And there's so many lyrics from this that you could kind of pull out. But it's like that I could never be great, held against such male tastes. I'll be up there with men and the 10 other women in the 100 greatest records of all time. It must be nice to be a man making boring music just because you can. And like, again, later on, Music by Men, she talks again about breaking her bones for 4 out of 5. And like that, it doesn't feel like she's feeling sorry for herself. I think it is just a very like real thing, especially that line I felt about how there's the top great 100 albums and there's only 10 women in there. Like, that stuff like that was very striking to me and like made me even more invested in what she's saying, and like made me more interested in her life and this album, and just even like sonically as well. I found it quite interesting because we see like how great she has been throughout her career, not even as a solo artist, but how she pursues like collaboration, like even working with like people like Calvin Harris or Lady Gaga, Taylor Swift. But it's, she's always really well kept her own singular voice too. Like, she's never kind of, I feel, compromised her own integrity or her own artistry, which I think is very commendable and very striking on this.
Keen, are there big Florence and the Machine anthems on this album, the way people would understand that?
There's big Florence and the Machine moments for sure. One of the Greats is definitely one of them. It's one of the longest tracks, and it's really sort of her soapbox moment. But I actually think she's better on this album when she's pared back a bit more. I think Witch Dance that we just heard there, I really love the start of that song, and then it kind of pivots into this sort of like screeching circle where she's practicing this art of keening, which is a grief ritual that comes from the Irish of to cry a queena, and it's kind of really loose in its structure, and it's a fun exploration of grief, and obviously it's, you know, really warranted from her. But I actually think a track like Buckle works really well. It's written by Mitski. It's a real sort of just simple guitar ballad, and it just lets her melodies and her voice shine much better, I think.
Okay, let's have a listen to that. And that is Buckle, Florence and the Machine from the Everybody Scream album. Let's get some stars from both of you, Keen.
Yeah, I gave it 3.5 stars. I really enjoyed it, but I don't think it's her best work. But I think if she was to do a more pared back acoustic live performance, I think she'd draw a lot on this album and I think it would work really well.
Okay, Sarah?
I was 3.5 as well, because I thought lyrically, as Keen said, this is her strongest work. There was just one or two moments where, like Sympathy, Magic or Old Religion, that it just felt a bit too Disney for me. I didn't love them. But everything else, I was really impressed with just the world building she did in this song, in this album.
Okay. Kat Burns has had some trajectory from the Brits School, which is famous for producing so many UK music stars over the last 20 years, to TikTok, to the star of Celebrity Traitors. If you haven't seen it yet, we're not going to reveal anything, but, you know, what is your sense of where she sits now as an artist, Cian?
So, yeah, like you said, she's kind of a... She's, I guess where she's sitting at the moment is to prove she's not a one-hit wonder. You know, Go was quite a big track after its viral success on TikTok in 2022, spilling into 2023. I think she's still operating in a space where there's a lot of goodwill. And I think people are still interested in going to see her at festivals and stuff like that. But I'm still wondering whether she's struggling to carve out her personality, both in the music and, as we saw on Celebrity Treaters, maybe on screen as well. Like, she's kind of did well on that show for going under the radar, and which is a good in a strategy, you know, a social game, but not great as a pop star.
The album deals with, amongst other things, Zara, grief, heartbreak. She uses voice notes and recordings quite openly in this. Do they make the album feel more intimate, or does that feel kind of forced?
See, voice messages and recordings and songs is one of my big gripes. I find them, they can be very, very difficult to pull off well. And like, I really appreciate what she was doing with this, like documenting, of course, for herself and for listeners, because a big part of her music is she wants to make pop music that people can get positive experiences out of sad experiences. I found them a little bit grating after a while.
It her just dead felt grandfather, like, come on.
I know, and I feel awful saying that, but it just felt a little intrusive. And then, like we're saying, it's also dealing with heartbreak, so it's just a bit of an odd switch between of like that, those modes. And also, like, the voice notes, I felt, and Keen and I were talking about this quite a lot during the week, it makes the album, I feel about 2 hours long in total. Okay. So it's not
I think the issue with the voice notes is she's telling you and she's not showing you.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm so sad, and there's a voice note of her crying, but at no point is she vocally giving you any sort of emotion, that she's not channeling that grief really into the emotions, and it kind of,
it's very flat.
It feels quite jarring as a contrast.
Okay, let's take something from the album. We'll have a listen to this. Cat Burns from How to Be Human, and this is called There's Just Something About Her. Cat Burns from How to Be Human, There's Just Something About Her. Cian, I mean, the timing of the release couldn't be better given that Celebrity Traders finished last night.
Absolutely. As soon as I saw the release date, I was like, oh, maybe someone does well on the Traders. You know, she's definitely going to have eyes on her, and people will be looking at this and going, oh, maybe I should check out her music. And look, I know it maybe feels like we're being a bit negative here. It's a really weird thing in that actually a lot of these songs pass muster on their own. It's a weird thing where actually this album is less than the sum of its parts, because if you put any of these random songs on a playlist, you'd be like, that's actually quite a nice upbeat, hopeful guitar folky pop song. The issue is the sequencing is dreadful. You basically have a glut of songs all about grief that all kind of sound the same, and then you have a glut of songs all about love that all kind of sound the same. And it, like Zara said, it ends up being feeling really repetitive and really long, and it's only 48 minutes.
Mm. But there's 16 songs on it as well.
Yeah. I kind of wondered if this could have been split over an album of 10 songs, maybe an EP to follow 6 months later, and maybe make it a bit more cohesive. Because like Keen is saying, and that song that we heard, there are moments that are bright and shiny and you are dancing in your chair, but then there's quieter songs like a When I'm With You, which I really liked the kind of Mac DeMarco-esque kind of feel. But nothing really sits very well together as a body of work. Like, it is quite a baffling album, I find, because she does have a great personality. Like, from The Traitors, I did like that, like you, Rick. I thought she seemed really cool, was really interested in her music, listened to her music, and I was like, oh. Like, and also I feel she gets quite lost in the songs. Like, the productions are bigger than she is. And also with that, the references that she's calling from, like a Sam Fender and Ed Sheeran, as we hear there, are more prominent than what Cat Burns wants to do, or what Cat Burns wants to play.
Okay, let's get some stars from both of you. Zara?
It was 2.5 for me.
Okay, Cian?
Yeah, unfortunately it's kind of the same. I think you can tell that she's a busker because she only really focuses on the song rather than the grand vision, unfortunately.
Okay, we're going to take a break and we'll be back with our final album for this week, the new one from White Lies. This is Friday Night's Arena. We're on to our final album, the new one from White Lies. This is from it. It's called Keep Up. And that is called Keep Up, White Lies, from the new album. It's called Nightlight. Zara, they were part of that kind of big mids, early 00s indie rock wave. Listening to the new album, has anything changed much for them in the interim?
Kind kind of a little bit. Like, they're adding more synths. Like, they did get Seth Evans in, who's collaborated with Black Midi in the past, so he's the external force here bringing that brightness to it. But I was very shocked to know that they were still going, and anyone that I said they had a new album out were also quite shocked. But I've been pleasantly surprised because I've really enjoyed this. Like, it has been nice to like hear the lads again, and also I found that like the musicianship between them was really, really strong actually. And they said that that came about from they were like practicing this album live quite a lot because they were inspired by, you know, 70s recordings, and I feel like that it comes across really well. There's a great chemistry in these songs, and they're very like stadium ready songs. Like, I feel like these could fill out the Three Arena and like people would be having a great out of time.
They've always been a bit of a chameleon band, key, and you can always hear influences of like everything from Joy Division to Editors and, you know, bits of Springsteen and all of that in it. When you hear this album, does it feel like homage? Does it feel like imitation?
I don't think it feels like that, although like they've, you know, they're not quite chameleons in this. They've swallowed the rock and roll Hall of Fame songbook, and they're basically reproducing it all, and they're kind of producing it in two waves as well. There's like a lot of 80s homages here. There's Pat Benatar power ballad guitar solos, there's Heartland Rock of Springsteen, there's Yacht Rock from Hall & Oates, and in the same songs there's also Kaiser Chiefs, Maximo Park and The Strokes. There's like literally anyone who's ever liked any song with a guitar will find like four different songs in this that they will love, and it'll all be the same song.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing, though?
I think it's a good thing. Like, I think, you know, you'll instantly feel familiar with these songs, and I think you're really going to enjoy them. Is it going to stop them from getting like a 5-star? I think so, because I think they lack an original stamp. But I think this is incredibly listenable, and I think if you stuck this on in the car, you would not notice the 40 minutes go by.
Yeah.
Do you think, Zara, that longevity that they've had, even though none of us were paying attention to it at the time, it's given them a kind of confidence to experiment with, you know, with structure, with atmosphere, with including all of those new sounds?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, what's kind of important with this band is they've been together making music since they were 15, and Talking Heads was like one of their big influences. And it does seem like that, like what Keane was saying with all the different references, I even had a few different ones as well. They seem to just love music, and they seem to love playing music together. And for me, the musicality of it really shone. The lyrical side of it didn't that much, but at the same time, like, I enjoyed listening to it, and I feel like it brought me back to when I was 17, 16, listening to White Lies. So it's always good to relive the good old days, isn't it?
Yeah, what more can you ask for? Yeah. Okay, give me some stars on this.
3 for me.
3. Keane?
A surprisingly enjoyable 3.5.
Okay. The albums that we were listening to this week were Florence and the Machine's Everybody Scream, the second album from Cat Burns called How to Be Human, and that was White Lies' 7th album, Night Light. They are all out and available now. Zara Hederman, Keane Sullivan, thank you for joining me tonight.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for us for this week, produced by Sheila O'Callaghan. Tonight, Paula Shields was our researcher. Our broadcast coordinator is Alexander Lopatin, and Mark Dwyer was on sound supervision. I'm Rick O'Shea. Have yourself a lovely weekend. Talk to you again on Monday from 7 here on Arena. John Creedon is next.